Hey folks, glad to be back with you again. My name is Henrik Palmgren, I'm from Sweden, and you are listening to an independent radio program. I hope you had a nice weekend. I know it was Thanksgiving over in the States, and no matter where you are, I hope you regularly not only celebrate and venerate, but also appreciate your ancestors and the founding of the country that you are in, and the sacrifices that they made so that you can have what you have today. And of course, we're not far away from Yule, the Blut, and Christmas before we move into the new year already. So there will be more of those kinds of celebrations coming up as well. Well, our website is redicecreations.com, and also check out redicesradio.net if you want to go straight to the radio archive. If you like what we do and want to hear more, please check out the members' website, redicemembers.com, where we have all our shows archived from our start back in 2006 all the way up till today, adding on several shows every week, over 1,000 shows now. And of course, we have our video material there as well, our inside episodes, films, and much more, so do take a look. Today we have prominent Atlanta attorney and Southern historian Sam Dixon with us. He attended the University of Georgia in the late 60s and was active in the conservative organizations Young Republicans and Young Americans for Freedom. He graduated from University of Georgia Law School in 1972 and opened his law offices in Atlanta. He's offered legal counsel to white activists in America. He's also a member of the Council of Conservative Citizens and has given lectures at Jared Taylor's American Renaissance. And by the way, this was recorded just a few days before Paris, BP, before Paris, right? Otherwise, we would have addressed this as well, obviously, in our talk. But this interview ended up being pushed back a few times so that we could squeeze in some short notice ones on the development in France. So it is a few weeks old, but it is as relevant as ever as we spent time discussing the history of America, the attack on the South, and the Reconstruction era, something you can do at any time. We also had the opportunity to talk about the big picture in Europe from revolutionary times in France up till today and the situation that has come of it. Stay tuned. Welcome, Mr. Dixon. Thank you so much for coming on the show with us. It's very nice to speak with you, and it's great to have you with us.
Well, the pleasure and honor are all mine. As I told you before, I am a great admirer of Scandinavians. I wish every Scandinavian had 20 children.
So do I. You know, you have a long career in some of the subjects, of course, that we address on the show. You've been a lawyer for many years as well. You're a veteran of sorts, if that's the right word, at the Amran events. You, of course, was at the latest MPI event where we met as well. What do you think some of the potential newcomers that we have with us, Sam, should know about your work and your background before we talk about some of the subjects we have lined up for today?
Well, I started out before I had a driver's license. Back in the early 60s, I started going to Goldwater meetings, and I've been at it ever since. And when I first got involved in 1963, when I was about 15, I was surprised to discover that these so-called conservatives were not interested in conserving the things that to me were the most important thing. I thought that the conservatives in the Buckley, the William F. Buckley Jr. Kitty Corps, the Young Americans for Freedom, I thought that certainly race would be the number one thing they'd want to conserve. But the first time I went to a meeting of Conservatism Inc., as we call it now, I learned otherwise. That their views on race were hardly any different from those of the Communist Party. They wanted to mix everybody up. They didn't think race mattered. They were extremely opposed to anybody interested in the survival of white people as a separate genetic subspecies of Homo sapiens. And that was the beginning of my very quick disillusionment with the establishment right.
Yeah, so they're anti-diversity, which is kind of interesting. When did you, if we can call it a race realist, when did you become aware of that as a subject and go into that area?
It's hard to say. I can never remember a moment of my life in which I was not interested in race. When I was a small child, I was very interested in how people looked. And my relatives would talk about people that members of our family were marrying, and what their family backgrounds were, and this sort of thing, and I would look at the fiancés of my cousins, and I would look at what they looked like and what their noses were like and what kind of color their hair and eyes. And people would talk about that, that this boy that's marrying this cousin is from a fine family. He's a Rutledge, he's got good features and stuff like this. And my grandmother lived in the area of South Carolina that was 95, or is today, 95% black. It was the rice-growing area just north of Charleston. And the blacks there were absolutely racially pure. They were so black, they were almost purple. And to me, it was just obvious that these were two very different strains of people. You had these, my relatives, who were English and French Huguenot and some German, and they really looked different from what white people look like today. They were really nice people, and there was never any question in my mind that this was a really serious difference between us.
Right. So do you think that the experiences of these differences were something that was more, more direct in the South as opposed to the North, if we go back in American history?
Yes, it was not a theoretical thing. It was a day-to-day practical thing. I was often in situations as a child in which I was the only white person there. Back then,
right,
race relations were peaceful enough where I could be walking down the street and be involved with black people and be a little white kid, and I could be safe with them. And my grandmother had servants, and I interacted with the servants, and we had very warm relations with the servants. The Marxists and others would dismiss that as paternalism and say, oh, you don't know what they really thought. I do know what they really thought, and my grandmother had great affection for her servants, and they had great affection for her. And she did many nice things for them. She and her husband helped put their kids through college. When my grandmother died, I was 16, the blacks did not come into the church. They could have come into the church under church doctrine, but as folk custom, they had their own churches. And when they carried my grandmother's coffin out of the church to go to the Presbyterian cemetery, the blacks were across the street, and they were sobbing. And I remember my grandmother's number one maid, Colada, came across the street with them crying, and she touched her handkerchief to my grandmother's coffin. And that was not something staged, as we would be told today in black history. It was a genuine sense of loss for somebody that had been an important figure in Colada's life, as Colada was an important figure in my grandmother's life.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of ridiculous the way that the history has been run by us, but I mean, if the whites were so racist, why did they let them raise their children? things like this, right? It's like,
well, that is something I don't approve of. As a Southerner, I can criticize the South, as I said at the NPI meeting. And the idea, and I never had children, but I can assure you, if I'd had a child, I would never have turned my child over to a black nanny to be raised. The idea that when your child is learning to speak, to have your child around anybody except somebody who's speaking King's English and using a decent vocabulary is just a non-starter in my book.
Yeah, wasn't there some that kind of adopted, what's that called, Gula, the tradition, or the
Gula,
language?
Gula. I can't understand Gula. The blacks spoke Gula. But the English they spoke was not good either. So, I was not reared as a little child with them. We lived in Atlanta, which was a big city, and we lived in an all-white neighborhood, and I was never around blacks, in any kind of intimate way when I was a small child learning to speak English. But I've never approved the idea of having the English, of having non-whites actually see nannies for children the way the English did in India, or the way many Southerners did in the Old South.
Yeah, we have a lot to talk about today. We're going to get into some of these issues later, but we wanted to talk a bit about the birth of the American nation and get closer to kind of the chronology, really, of what has happened and work our way up towards where we are today. Why don't you take us back a bit and tell us, you've done some really interesting work on this, also, of course, with the separation from the British Empire, and you have some, opinions that a lot of Americans don't hold today in terms of the separation. Tell us, walk us through a bit, if you will, Sam.
Well, let's start with the very birth of the nation at Jamestown, the settlement of Virginia, and the settlement of Massachusetts Bay Colony. I didn't have any ancestors in Virginia, but I had ancestors in Massachusetts, and later had Massachusetts ancestors in South Carolina when South Carolina was settled. The fatal flaw, I think, was that people were allowed to choose to come to America. In ancient times, in the Roman Empire, when a country colonized another area, they would take whole villages and settle them there almost involuntarily. The Byzantine Empire did that later in the Middle Ages. The way it ought to have been done, in my opinion, is that the king should have sealed off a village, say in Yorkshire, prevented anybody from leaving, put the whole village on boats, and simply relocated the village in America where it would be a true New England. The reason why I think it was so fatal is that by allowing people to choose to come to America, it was selective for the genes of people who are like gypsies, for whom things like race, religion, language, these values are not very important. They're certainly not primary values. My grandmother used to say that we were pioneers and not immigrants, and she would distinguish between, back then this was common, she would distinguish between people who came early in the history of the country, like our French Huguenot ancestors, because they weren't brought over by factories like the Ellis Island people. But in later years, I rethought that. I came to realize that even when you're dealing with people like the Pilgrim Fathers in Massachusetts or the French Huguenots in South Carolina, you're dealing with people for whom community is not a critical value. The French Huguenot ancestors, for instance, these were people for whom the question of how many sacraments there were became more important than living at peace with their neighbors
right. In
the town where their ancestors had lived for centuries, and most of the people were actually their distant cousins, because they decided that there were two sacraments instead of seven, as the Church of Rome taught. They would rather leave France than change that opinion. They would go to a faraway wilderness. Now, Americans admire that, but I've come not to admire that. I think it creates a population that is very difficult to use to form a nation.
Well, they're willing to uproot in a way that the other Europeans didn't. Even though they weren't through hardship, they decided to stay, and they sought that to be more important than to leave and try your luck somewhere else, right?
That's exactly right. I think it was James Truscott Adams, the historian, who raised the question in his introduction to an edition of The Education of Henry Adams. And he said, which set of Puritans was the braver, the ones who got on boats and came to New England, or the ones who remained and stayed in England under the Tudor death, under the Stuart despotism, and fought the Stuarts, and overthrew the Stuarts? You know, they weren't willing to give up turf. They weren't willing to leave their towns and villages. They held their turf. You look at other areas, which is a shift from the Anglo-Saxons to our European cousins, the Spaniards, who held their turf in the face of 700 or 800 years of relentless conflict against the Moors, the Greeks, who didn't just all pack up and move out of Greece when the Turks conquered them. I hate to say this as an American, but I think that the people who stayed in Europe constitute a much better construction material for a nation than the people who have come here.
That's very interesting, you know, because I've heard the opposite so many times, that, well, they were more brave. They left and they accepted the challenges that we didn't and whatnot. But you have a really good point. I mean, what is the quality then, if we can call it that, of the American as opposed to the European? And is this why we see such vast differences today between America and Europe?
I think the differences, by the way, are overstated between Americans and Europeans. But yes, I think Americans were not only indoctrinated in the ideology of freedom, as I call it, they were a natural market for an ideology of freedom. Because these were people who found the community to be suffocating. You know, they wanted to get out of their towns in Poland or Germany or Sweden or Scotland or England. They wanted to get away and be free. Other people that remained there did not find community life to be suffocating. They didn't want to be free of community. I don't want to be free of community. I want community. As an American, I'm not allowed to have any.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know. What do you think about we might be getting ahead of ourselves a little bit here, but do you ever think there'll be such a thing as a return to Europe movement, especially now when we see what's happening in Europe, to go back and to participate in the battle for Europe?
Oh, I think a lot of Americans are interested in going back to Europe. Whether they will help Europe remains to be seen, but I'm on the phone right now sitting in the office of a lawyer friend of mine in Atlanta, and he's going to great trouble to try to get passports, European passports for his children, because he sees very little future in America, and he wants his children to be able to have the option of going back to Great Britain.
Right, exactly. And I could imagine that that's really difficult in these times.
Well, it is difficult. For one thing, whites are not wanted in Europe. If instead of being the children of a successful lawyer and kids who will have college educations of their own and being nice-looking white guys and girls, if these were Syrians, the riffraff of the Middle East, the red carpet would be rolled out for them. But that's not the case, because Europeans don't want that type any more than Americans want attractive Europeans coming here. The American government doesn't want that type either.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about that later. It's aggravating. But yeah, let's go back again and talk a bit more about the separation between the British and America. This idea, tell us more about freedom first, actually. This idea that, America has created a very different system, much more free market, of course, more capitalistic. It's more today, more materialistic. I don't know if that's a natural kind of progression to what you were talking about in terms of having the freedom as the highest kind of virtue, if you will.
Well, America is basically started out as a Whig country. If you know British history, the Tories were the ones who sided with the Crown and the aristocracy, and the Church of England. The Whigs were the party that were opposed to the Crown. They were the parties of the Calvinists and Presbyterians and Puritans. They were the party of the bourgeoisie as opposed to the aristocracy. America is all Whig. Contrary to the claims of the Virginians, very, very few monarchists or aristocrats came to America. They were mostly Whigs. They were not Tories. So America it started out as an England with all Whigs and no Tories. And the Whigs were very much into freedom. You had the Protestant idea of individual education and some degree of individual choice. You had the fact that the entrepreneurial classes, the business classes, were the ones who became Puritans. They wanted a free market. They were opposed to the monopolies that were granted to the aristocrats. So they were a natural market for libertarian-type ideologies. What started out as the philosophy of John Locke in Jefferson's time and has evolved now into the very extreme thing we call libertarianism, which is truly a poisonous idea. But one thing that intellectuals of all stripes, especially Marxists, but also our own, don't think about is that an idea, an abstraction, a philosophy, has to be placed into an actual human context.
Yeah. Right.
As somebody pointed out, they've had decentralized government and states' rights in the Congo for thousands of years, but it hasn't worked.
Right, yeah.
These philosophies like states' rights, which is a peculiar thing in America, the decentralized government, this worked over here because you had 13 colonies strung out along a coast of some 1,500 miles with lots of land and the inability really to communicate very easily with each other and no need really to communicate with each other. In the Dutch War for Independence against the Spaniards, The Dutch had a system of states' rights, and it was almost fatal to Dutch independence. They could not mobilize their armies. They could not conduct military strategy against the Spaniards without all the states agreeing. All the United Provinces had to agree, and so states' rights didn't work very well in Holland. That war for independence could have been over in 18 months, but instead it lasted 80 years because the Dutch were so decentralized. America could afford this individual freedom and decentralized government in a way that, say, Russians could not. You know, Russians could survive and could become free and remain Russians only under a czar like Dmitry Donskoy, who would defeat the Mongols and break the control of the Mongol Empire and protect them from the Turks and the very dangerous people that they had contesting with them for that land. In America, the only people contesting with us were these Stone Age Indians who were very easily brushed aside, and Americans could then congratulate themselves, oh, we believe in freedom, and look how well it works over here. The Europeans are not like us. They don't understand how great freedom is. Well, if Prussia had had freedom, or Poland had had freedom, or Russia had had freedom in the sense that America had it, there would be no Prussians, there'd be no Poles, there'd be no Russians.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So anyway, we start out as a Whig nation. We start out and therefore, unfortunately, antagonistic towards Britain. And that then led to the separation from Britain, which I think was also a very bad thing.
Do you think that the British Empire was a horrible, horrible thing, or has this been vehemently demonized as so many other Western things that comes to us through civilization?
Well, I think, like Lee said, of slavery, I think the British Empire was a great blessing for the people that Britain ruled, and to some extent was harmful to Britain itself.
In what way? Explain that a bit more.
Well, I contrary to what the Marxists and the emerging nations like to rant and rave about in the United Nations, Britain lifted all of these people from the earth, from the dirt, and made them into much more than they ever were before. You know, India, for instance, didn't even exist when the British arrived. They were just a bunch of squabbling states, and the Muslims were gradually exterminating the native religion. You know, under the British, they had built railroads. They rediscovered the past. The English discovered the ancient connection of Sanskrit to Greek and Latin. Their archaeologists recreated the history of India. Basically, the whole concept of India and the Indian awareness of the whole scope of their civilization and culture is something that was created by the English.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's still, as you say, infrastructure that stands there today being utilized, and many have spoken dearly about when the British actually ruled in India, you know?
Yeah, but for the British, it brought them power for a while, but it eventually sapped them. And the cost of maintaining the empire was too great. They sent many of their best people forth who died in India and elsewhere without having children. And they did not focus on building up their own native land, which I think contributed to World War I. It contributed to the British entry into World War I because they were jealous of the Germans who did focus on building up their own country. But let's return to America. Let's go back and finish our chronology of America. The separation from Britain was a bad thing because, one thing, it cut us off from the monarchy. And I think monarchy is a very much healthier system than democracy. Even a ceremonial monarchy like you have in Sweden or that still exists in Great Britain, I think brings psychological blessings to the people that the monarch rules. And by separating from the king and developing this false narrative of how we were oppressed by the English, it reinforced our sense of separation from Europe. It created the America we know today, in which a political candidate like Mitt Romney in the last presidential election could get votes by going around saying, we don't want to be like Europe. Well,
right.
I do want to be like Europe.
Yeah.
I like Europe. I am a European. I may be living in America, and my family has lived in America since the 1620s, but I look like a European. Europeans look like my cousins. I speak a European language. I have a European religion. I am a European, just like a cabbage growing in a carrot patch is still a cabbage. And I see nothing wrong with being European. I like Europe. I even like a lot of the socialism in Europe. But Americans have this skewed attitude toward Europe that started with the break with England. And then further, the way it happened was bad. It was like the difference between a child leaving the house to marry and start a family of his own and going to having a wedding and having his parents there with his wife's parents. And the difference between that kind of separation from your father's home and some child going berserk and running away from home at 14 to become a skinhead. And basically, America ran off to become skinheads.
Right, right.
And so that was bad. And then that was compounded by the Declaration of Independence, a truly iniquitous document that has done incalculable harm, not only to America, but to Europe.
Explain that a bit more.
Well, when you start out, it was written, initially the colonists were not fighting for abstractions. The original demands that they made in 1775 were for the rights of Englishmen. Now, the rights of Englishmen were something which were defined. You knew what they were. They'd been defined through 700 or 800 years of the Anglo-Saxons and Normans and Celts fighting with each other and fighting as aristocrats against the king or Puritans against the aristocrats. These things have been hammered out for almost 1,000 years of experience in living on the same island. And you knew what those rights were. They'd been codified in the Declaration of Rights in 1689 when the real Stuart king was overthrown and an end was had to the idea of absolute monarchy. And those were things like the right to a jury trial, the presumption of innocence in criminal cases, no use of torture, the right of habeas corpus. These were very specific things, but quickly, in order to bring in the French, who were already drunk on Rousseau and Voltaire, Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, and it ceased being a struggle for the rights of Englishmen and became a struggle for freedom, for the ideology of freedom, for the whimsy of the French Enlightenment. And so you have the Declaration of Independence that begins with these words, which Americans just love and almost have orgasms hearing. But those of us who are chatting today on this broadcast, you, me, and our listeners, to us as communitarians and thoughtful people, I don't think that they will resonate so well. And so what were those words? When in the course of human affairs it becomes necessary for one people to separate blah, 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 and we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are the rights to happiness and whatever.
Yeah.
Now, let's deconstruct those words for a moment. First of all, it's not self-evident at all. In fact, it's self-evident that this is all nonsense. It's what the Germans call Wahnsinnigkeit. It's insanity. All men are created equal. There's no man on earth, even an identical twin, is not equal to his identical twin.
Right.
And all men? Well, we knew what the rights of an Englishman were. Well, what about the rights of somebody in New Guinea? No.
Yeah.
Englishmen had rights that people in New Guinea didn't have because the Englishman's ancestors had fought for and established and worked out a national agreement on how the king was going to deal with the subject and how the subject was going to deal with his neighbor and how the subject was going to deal with the crown. And all this elaborate setup had been created out of 1,000 years of shared experience. But to just say that there are all these rights that have been given to these equal people in Tibet and the Australian Aborigines and the Pygmies. That all these people are equal, and that they've been given inalienable rights. Well, if they're inalienable, they can't be given up. Why then was it that in 1776, Britain was the freest country on earth, and most countries had no concept of freedom at all? You didn't have any freedom in Spain under the absolute monarchy.
No.
So they were alienable. But this insanity was then carved on monuments in America, memorized by school children, and it played into a problem, I think, that exists with the Anglo-Saxon character, and that is these abstractions became even more abstract, which is true for Anglo-Saxons. Abstractions are more abstract for Anglo-Saxons than they are, I think, for any other people in Europe, for linguistic reasons.
Right.
But anyway, it's just been the bane of our existence ever since.
Well, this is obviously the path of equality that we're talking about here, and maybe the reason why we see America act the way it does might be due to documents like this. You of course, had in, was it in France, you had the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizens, right? And it was in 1789.
The people who were chopping off the heads of everybody that looked better than somebody else.
Well, exactly. And how do you view such things as let's say the Jacobins, the influence of the Nine Sisters Lodge and the Sister Revolution that was happening in France at the same time? Is this the ideas that kind of fueled what was happening in America at the same time?
In a way, fortunately, we had Washington, who was sort of almost like a monarch himself, and an aristocrat and a gentleman. We had him, whereas the poor French succumbed to Marat and Robespierre. You know, again, ideas are changed by being placed in circumstances, actual physical circumstances. So we were spared that. Although the revolution was not what we're told in our schools, all these sort of gentlemanly people, we forget what was done to the Tories, the lynchings, the burnings, the rapes, the tarring and feathering, the expulsion of one out of every 30 people in the country, with no compensation for their property. You know, that's an aspect of the American Revolution that Americans never look at. But it still was not like the Vendée in France or the Reign of Terror.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely...
But the core ideas were there. And those ideas, especially when coupled with the feeling of alienation from Europe, provided the perfect combustible material in the 20th century... when certain powerful interest groups wanted to manipulate the United States into intervening in European wars for their own benefit.
Right, yeah. Now, do you see America in this regard as a kind of a libertarian experiment that they were trying to attempt to achieve something which hasn't been done before, and America was just kind of ripe for the picking at the time? Or how do we explain the intentions that brought this together?
Well, I think we did explain it. That is, there was a natural market for it in terms of the people who came to America, the Whigs. And then it was these were the ideas of the time. You know, Voltaire wasn't just confined to France. You know, he went to Prussia and was a friend of Frederick the Great, and his writings were read all over Europe, even in Russia. And it was the time of the French Enlightenment. So it was the wrong idea meeting the wrong material at the wrong time.
I mean, it seems impossible today to reverse something like this, which is so ingrained now, although it hasn't been a constant, of course, in human history, not at all. It's fairly recent in that context, but it seems so ingrained, and it seems like people are so afraid of hierarchy or aristocracy or class or any kind of benevolent elite, you know?
Well, there's always an elite that, contrary to what people think, you know, the elites move every society and every generation. I think it can be replaced. I think it will be replaced. I believe in natural law. I retain the residue of my religious upbringing that people must walk in the paths of righteousness. That is, that they must conform themselves to the laws that govern creation. And this equality thing is just a madness. It's something that will die out, as communism was unable to function in Russia So this stuff cannot really function in America. It's had a lucky, it's had fantastic luck, like a poker player who's had 10 hands dealt and always got aces in every suit in his hand. You know, as I said, America had no real enemies. The Indian tribes were no threat. They had a whole continent of unlimited resources, forests that had never been touched by a metal axe, you know, oil that was just lying on top of the ground in Pennsylvania, rich farmland that hadn't been eroded like the farmland in Calabria or Sicily. And so it was easy for Americans to have a high standard of living and then to think, well, this is because we're free and those people in Sicily aren't free. Once again, looking at time and place and actual physical circumstances, whatever kind of government Sicily has will have to deal with the reality that the topsoil was all washed away 2,000 years ago.
Right.
And that you're always going to be short of food. Food is not going to be easy to get if you live in Sicily, whether it's governed by communists, libertarians, fascists, liberal democracy. The fact of no soil is just a fundamental reality. In America, it was easy to look at what was happening and how easily we were expanding and annexing all these territories and just more food than you could possibly eat and a comfortable climate, all these things, and say, oh, this is the result of the Constitution, of our libertarian experiment, of our decentralized government. This is, if only the Europeans would adopt this, if the Swedes would just get rid of their king and divide the country up into provinces and decentralize and take the power out of Stockholm and put it in these provinces and set everybody free, then the Swedes could have an easy life as we do. But of course, you being a Swede know that you're cold 8 months of the year.
Yeah, that's correct.
And it's hard to get. You don't have fields of waving wheat in Switzerland. You have to have the peasants out struggling, hoping that the frost won't be early this year so you can get a little barley and oats. You know, it's deceptive, but Americans are deceived by that. But the string of good luck is over. America's now heading into a hurricane, and people are going to have to adjust their thinking because the good times here are over.
Very interesting. Very good point. I have not really thought about that before. All things matter, and all things are very, very. It's like America was a land of milk and honey, right? And it was they could get from it whatever they wanted. You know,
it's all handed to them on a silver platter.
Yeah, interesting. Now, some say though that, you know, initially the settlement of America, I don't want to call it immigration. It became that later, of course. But the early Europeans they came, they were pioneers. They were settlers. There wasn't a system of where they can go on the dole and go to a government office first thing when they arrived. So it was very different. But nonetheless, when they came in and settled, was there restrictions in the early days from what countries they could come in from? Meaning when they talked about the inalienable rights and all these things, some people have pointed out that was just concerning the people who came to America, that these were of European stock. What do you say about that?
Well, that's what they had. They had blacks, were the only significant non-European minority, and they had no say at all. I know that they had a naturalization act in the very first years of the country, and it wasn't a matter of just the melting pot and the open door. But as a practical matter, people back then had a hard time getting around. So. And moving into strange countries. You didn't move from Syria to Sweden in 1620 or 1795. You know, you just couldn't do it. And, so it remained European, but it had this chip on the shoulder towards Europe, and it had this deadly ideology about inalienable rights and everybody being created equal. What I wonder, Henrik, is what is the attraction of equality?
I don't know.
From what I see, lots of people in the world, even in Europe, find the idea of equality attractive. You ask when I first came aware of race. I think I can truthfully say that I have never been interested in equality for as long as I can ever remember.
Right.
Not because I think I'm some kind of paragon or an aristocrat. It's just the very idea is just repulsive. What high school boy, I don't know what sport you play in Sweden, but, in my high school, nobody in my high school on the baseball team said, gee, I sure hope we're the most equal baseball team this year and that we will have the most equal, most average baseball scores, and that I can be the most equal average person on my team.
I know. Well, I mean, we can laugh at it still, but I mean, this is changing now. Competition is seen as reprehensible in some cases. They're starting to take out, competitive sports out of schools and things like this, and it's becoming politically incorrect if we're not all winners, right? So we're creating these really weakened human beings, and Europeans primarily, that are unable to compete and develop some tough skin, if you know what I mean.
Well, you use the first person plural, we. We are not doing that. Our enemies are doing that.
That's correct. Yeah. We're allowing it for now, right?
But we wonder, why do our people find the concept of equality? When you get on a plane, do you want the most equal person on the plane to be the pilot?
No, I want the best.
No, I'm not interested in having an election for pilot. I'm not interested in going to the airport and having Delta Airlines announce that we're going to vote on who the pilot's going to be.
Right. And you'd think that smart and intelligent people would recognize that the same would be true for leadership of any country or any authority.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, it's so strange. You know what? You said something about libertarianism. I wanted to ask you about that before we move on as well. In the face of demographics in particular, libertarianism is looking like an increasingly stupid idea to me and have for some time. Can you explain a bit more of why you think that is something that won't work in the long run if we take demographics into account? Why is it such a bad idea?
Well, we know from human experience that they've had libertarianism in the Congo, as I've said, for a long time, and it just doesn't work. Libertarianism can only function in a white society that has already been civilized and tamed and calmed down and all this as our society has been. So we know historically that it will never work outside an all-white perspective. One of the things that gives me hope is the irrepressible conflict that is rising between white liberals and the non-whites. This is truer in America than it is in Europe, because the left in Europe is more of a uniform, hardcore Marxist group that has no interest in freedom, and in fact, secretly, I suspect, is greatly interested in the idea of gulag concentration camps.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Oh yeah, I think if you give a dose of sodium pentothal, truth drugs to leftists in Europe, and many of them in America, you would find that beneath the liberal exterior, there beats the heart of a Bela Kun or Leon Trotsky.
I think you're right.
And they're just fantasizing over the idea of taking people down to the cellar in Ekaterinburg and murdering them. But there are a lot of genuine liberals, what you might call old believer liberals in America, who believe in things like freedom of speech. These people and the American liberal movement created an alliance with these non-whites, and they thought they were going to manipulate the non-whites, that they were going to enfranchise the blacks. The blacks would vote for them. That way they could take over the Congress like they did in the Watergate Congress, and they could pass all these laws about protecting the environment and creating more national parks and giving more rights to homosexuals and all this sort of thing. The minority racists were never interested in any of these liberal causes. They are not interested today. They don't give a damn about saving the whooping cranes or
no.
Endangered species or the rights of homosexuals. The reason the non-whites voted for the liberal minority racist coalition was that they were interested in one thing, and that thing was the gimme of being able to vote for a living and take things away from richer white people, transfer wealth and income to themselves. Demographically now, the white liberals are down to a fairly small minority in that coalition, and the the non-whites are increasingly aware that they no longer need the white liberals. So you see things like what happened in the University of Missouri last week here in America, or at Yale a week or two ago, where the non-whites now can just treat white liberals with contempt, and I read a lot of liberal and leftist websites. I think you really need to read people who are opposed to you, and talk to people who are opposed to you, and not get walled off into a ghetto of fellow believers. These liberal websites are now full of arguments between white liberals and non-whites over things like what has happened at the University of Missouri. And the non-whites reply with just contempt to the white liberals. You know, we're not interested in your freedom of speech. We've had 300 years of racism, and we're not tolerating it anymore.
Yeah. Well, look at what happened during the Bernie Sanders speech in Seattle, if you saw that. That was a good example, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And we can rejoice. Well, it's very important. If there's one thing I would like to say to everyone that's listening to this, our morale is very important. And it is easy to get depressed over things like what happened at the University of Missouri or what's happening now with the invasion of Germany by the Syrians. Actually, we should be happy over these things. They're forcing people to face reality. They're going to force white people to come to their senses and eventually embrace us and what we stand for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so when I look at something like Missouri, the University of Missouri, this is just wonderful. Every black football player in America now knows that the football team is more important than the president of the college in American colleges. American so-called college education is about football. It's not about actual education. It's about football. And if the blacks refuse to play football, as they did at the University of Missouri, they can dictate who can be the president of the university. They can fire administrators. They can remove professors. This is a wonderful thing. There's no reason for us to grieve about this. We should rejoice in such things.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems to be a lot of, that the liberal kind of agenda of where they wanted to take this is kind of falling apart. But it's really just a way. I mean, if the intention here has been to destroy the West, if their intention is not to, build their kind of utopia, whatever, this could be argued if this is a part of their tenets or whatnot, but they are succeeding in destroying the West by opening, the borders and then converting people over to, liberalism or turning them into progressives or whatnot. And here we stand with everything in shambles. And so, I understand that depravity and that sense of the fact that this is, It looks hopeless, but you believe that out of that, out of this conflict that is now initiated, we'll see something true and solid rise out of that?
Well, we certainly want the existing order to change. If things don't change, we are finished.
That's right. Yeah.
And so we want the regime to fail. We want the system to fail. And I hope most people realize that we cannot talk any longer about reforming the regime. The regime has to go. We need regime change in Washington and Stockholm and London and Berlin. We need regime change, and not merely a change of government, but a change of the whole nature of the system, the whole way that society is organized. And so these events here that are disrupting education, which in our country, by the way, is entirely a matter of catechization. If they disrupt education in America, that's a good thing for us because nothing helpful is being taught in American colleges except chemistry and physics and that kind of thing. So if they shut them all down, it'd be good for us. But you've got to have this. And, the ancient Greeks said, Aeschylus said, pathemata mathemata. We by suffering we learn.
Right. Yeah.
And so that, yes, suffering is a law of Zeus, as it says I think, in Oedipus Rex, that there is this changeless law that man must learn by suffering. There's a great English proverb, which I love. Proverbs are now almost extinct. I love proverbs. That the burnt child minds the stove, in the old sense of mind, that he's careful of the stove. When the child burns his hand on the eye of the stove, he learns about what that glowing red stove eye means.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, we're certainly, or we, I'll stop using that word. You pointed that out because you're correct. They are doing it to us, but so far we're going along with it. That's my point. That's why I used the we. But you know, Swedes could become a minority among 16-year-old boys as early as 2016. That's next year. I mean, what kind of future do you think we're looking at if we become minorities in our own countries within Europe? And this is really close in some European countries now due to what's happened during this summer, but also the recent 10, 15 years of this insane immigration policy, open borders, basically.
Well, I think it's going to be a question of whether white people can toughen up. You know, if you look across the Baltic from your homeland in Stockholm, and you look at the three Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, these are countries that have suffered in a way that's unimaginable to Swedes or Americans. You know, just during the 1 year of the Soviet occupation after the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, the one out of every 10 people in those countries was killed.
Yeah.
And when the Soviet Union began collapsing, when their system began collapsing, as our system will collapse, some of those countries, I think Latvia was only 52% Latvian. They had been heavily colonized by Russians. But that little 52% of Latvia, I don't think they're hardly, barely over a million Latvians, they were determined to have their country back again. And by God, they got it, even though they were only a 52% majority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
So it's a matter of the will.
Yeah.
And Swedes and Americans have had it very easy, and they're very weak, and they're very individualized. The most important thing is to get rid of the individualism, even before toughening up physically and mentally and morally. You've got to get rid of the individualism.
Yeah, we become so atomized. We rely on, you know, services for everything. And despite that, society like Sweden that is so conformist and so collectivist in one way, it's highly, highly individualized, which is kind of strange and seems like a contradiction. But it's really how things have turned out. And now we've, unfortunately, through the adaptation of a more, it's kind of like a so-called free market system. We had the moderate party in power for 8 years in Sweden. Supposedly they are the, you know, conservative right-wing alternative, but that should be argued, of course, of what kind of politics they really run. But nonetheless, they reformed Sweden economically in such a way that it no longer resembles the old Sweden that we think about. And it seems like such an uphill battle, Sam, to not only, of course, struggle with the increasing immigrant population, but just the internal strifes of the Swedish people and those who want to try to save the country and get it back up on its feet, and those who are fighting against it and even think that the borders that even is there is too much. You know, we should completely open it up. So it's a very delicate time right now. We have a small window of where we might be able to achieve something if we are to save the nation that is Sweden, that is.
I don't agree. I don't think that's a helpful way to look at it. I think we should think and act as if we have lots of time. And I think that you know, there will be opportunities. And it's inconceivable that 500 or 600 million white people are just going to walk off the stage of history into oblivion.
Right.
The system has been able to buy people off. You know, the two world wars in which the egalitarians and the communists and so forth emerged as the victors have been followed by unending prosperity. And this system has never been challenged. Yeah, there's never been a challenge to the system. Since Roosevelt's election in America, there's never been any real challenge to the system. There's never been a situation in which the country was really involved in a desperate war with real suffering, or that the crops had failed and people were starving. There's never been that kind of thing. And it's easy to run a country and to appear securely in power and secure in your place at the head table when you've had three generations of prosperity and peace.
Yeah,
Yeah, the Vietnam War is, you know, people to me, Americans say, what are you talking about? We had the Vietnam War. That's just a joke. You know, Great Britain lost more men on the first day of the Battle of the Somme in World War I, with a population one-fifth our size, than we lost in the entire Vietnam War. And Britain didn't dissolve. I wish it had, because then there could have been negotiated peace before the Tsar was overthrown and the Kaiser. But Britain did not dissolve. They went on, having lost 55,000 men in one day. Whereas in America, losing 55,000 people with a population of 250 million, losing 55,000 people over a period of 7 or 8 years, virtually brought the country to the stage of collapse. Which tells you how little resilience there is in the superficially impressive system that rules us.
Yeah, I think it was Jonathan Bowden that pointed out the British soldiers, they cried when their iPods was removed from them and they no longer can listen to their pop music. And we have American soldiers walking around in red high heels to support the feminist movement. I bet you, you know, ISIS looks at this and just tremble in their boots when they see American and European forces right now, you know?
Yep.
It's so strange. It's so bizarre, you know. But Sam, we're going to take a break in a few minutes here, and then we're going to continue in the second hour. I want to talk more about your view on the future, of course, and what's going on right now with the invasion. Demographically speaking, what's going to happen in America and Europe. There's much more to get into here, but why don't we talk a bit more about if there's any websites you'd like to give out? I mean, where can people go to read more of your work? Tell us if you have something available out there that people can pick up copies of.
Unfortunately, I'm very bad about not writing. I give talks, but I don't write. I'm very busy professionally, and I should have written more. There's very little I can tell. The only thing that I've written that has been widely disseminated is an attack on Abraham Lincoln entitled Shattering the Icon of Abraham Lincoln. And that's available online. If you just type in Shattering the Icon of Abraham Lincoln, you'll find this little monograph that I wrote that has been distributed in some tens of thousands of copies around the country, and which, if I do say so myself, I think has actually affected to some small degree how Americans view Abraham Lincoln.
Well, interesting. We'll definitely make sure to add a link to that. And of course, we'll add some link to many of your talks is up on YouTube, available there. As I said, a lot of them are done at American Renaissance, but also NPI. And I think there are some others as well around. So we'll make sure to add links to mm-hmm. those. When you do write, I guess you have some published on AmericanRenaissance.com as well now and then. Is that correct?
I really don't write for them like I should. I have written once or twice for the Occidental Quarterly and for the Occidental Observer. One of my New Year's resolutions last year was to start writing regularly for VDare and Occidental Quarterly and Occidental Observer, but I have not kept that resolution. I'll try to keep it in 2016.
All right. Okay. Well, very good. There's some stuff that people can tune into here, of course, lectures and whatnot. So we have links to that. But all right. Well, we'll take a short break here. Stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us, Sam. We'll be right back after the break. Thank you. Don't miss our second hour. We have more coming up as we continue with Sam Dixon. We get a more detailed view of the migrants moving into Europe in the next segment. We're talking about the importation of a new proletariat to continue the Marxist revolution. We go into some solutions as well. What to do? What direction do we go? We discuss how to keep morale high, and at the same time, we need to give people the reality of the bad news. We discuss Merkel in some more detail and what will happen to her, especially considering that she not only hates Germany and the Germans, she has made sure that some of her people have lost their homes, been kicked out from their apartments or elderly care to give way for migrants that she and the others seem to value more than their own population. So the question is, how long can this go on before someone actually does something about this? We also talk a bit about eugenics, fertility, birth rates of the Europeans, and that we have to take a long-term view on these incredibly important issues. Sam gives us a few suggestions and advice towards the end as well. So don't miss it, ladies and gentlemen. Sign up, it's only €5 per month. That's about $5 American dollars in current exchange rate. The shortest subscription we offer is 3 months, but we have all the way up to 2 years as well. Whatever works for you, and whatever you choose, you can download everything in our archives, if you so please. So if you value an independent media that is giving you not only the real story and the full picture of the ongoing population replacement by the establishment, but also an insight and discussions with some of the most vilified and demonized people that are actually objecting to this crime. If you value that, please sign up. And at the same time, of course, you help us keep growing and expanding in our coverage. The website is redicemembers.com. Go there. All the information is right there for you. And by the way, we have more guests coming up, of course, Jenny Upton and also Gavin Kilgore. If you want to see the full list of upcoming guests, please take a look in the radio archives. But we'll take a short break right here, and then we'll return with Sam Dixon in the next hour.